entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. till noon Pacific time, we will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising your children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, our topic today is the cart before the horse? Failure to launch and substance use disorders. To talk about this and more, our guest, Gary Hees, is the clinical director for Decision Point Center, a leading treatment program for young adults treating failure to launch and various degrees of substance use disorder, and their program is located in Prescott, Arizona. Gary, who received his master's degree from the University of Houston Clear Lake in psychology and marriage and family therapy, has been licensed as such in Texas and now in Arizona. He has worked with adolescents in an alternative education program, with adult co-occurring disordered clients in a community mental health setting, and in a private therapeutic boarding school for adolescent women. Gary brings a foundational developmental and systematic perspective to his years of experience working with addictions of all kinds, including depression, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and bipolar disorder. Gary, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hey, thank you, Alan, and thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you on. And before we go into this topic, please share a little bit about Decision Point's 12-year history.
Oh, gosh. Decision Point has been in business for about 12 years. We've been through several iterations of how we do things, arriving at a wonderful approach that we're in the midst of implementing now, that recognizes the fact that many of our young adults nowadays have developmental issues that actually leave them vulnerable to addictive use or to simple abuse of drugs and alcohol. And probably the key to all of that is the fact that we are implementing a two-week-long assessment period when they come in, looking at lots of factors, not just how much they drink or don't drink, how much they use or don't use.
Okay, well, I mean, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about that that two-week assessment and evaluation.
Gotcha. Well, when a person first comes into us, what we will be doing, number one, we have our own detox facility that is part of our organization. So if that's called for, we can take care of that as well. What we do in assessment, though, when they come in, is we want to look at the entire person. I want to do a psychiatric assessment. I want to do a psychological assessment, including assessment for depression, anxiety, and also, very importantly, an assessment of where they stand as a young adult in terms of educational achievement. We want to do a full medical assessment. In many cases, young adults coming in actually have underlying thyroid issues, underlying endocrinological issues, that, if cleared up or if left untreated, rather, I should say, actually exacerbate some of what goes on in the mind of a person who is abusing or addicted to substances. We want to fully look at nutrition as well. What is that type? What is going on with them there? Because a diet of frozen pizza isn't good for anyone. Exactly. The other things are really, how do they do on self-care? What kind of career counseling, if any, have they ever had? Do they have an internal or an external locus of control? That is, are they influenced by other people around them, or do they see themselves as primarily responsible for what happens to them in their life, and therefore, do they take initiative to make changes in their life? We need to look at personality development. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, a lot of these young adults, and I'll say it a little bit humorously, are basically camped out in their parents' basement, abusing substances and playing video games. And they are wonderfully intelligent young people with tremendous potential to do almost anything they want. But what we need to figure out is what happened to them as they developed, and what shoring up do we need to do in terms of the stages of personal development to help them get on with and, in fact, formulate a purpose that they want to pursue in life. For instance, Alan, I was in the information technology field for a little over 20 years, and coming into recovery myself, which I'm a little bit past 26 years now, going into recovery myself is what really motivated me to stop and say, what purpose do I want to pursue in life? And out of that came returning from my master's and going into the behavioral health field. I want to help these young people, hopefully before the age of 42, like myself, to begin to formulate those decisions and get a purpose, a mission in life, if you will. And then I want to see how my organization can help them pursue that in terms of getting them to actually develop into more adult thinking, reconnecting them with college and educational opportunities, working with their family, like the title of your show, Alan, working with their family so that their family does not unknowingly actually reinforce this pattern of them simply using substances and escaping life.
Well, and I think you bring up a great point about reinforcing it, or that the term that we all know as in enabling. You know, and when you mentioned about, you know, the in the basement playing video games and getting high, I think that that's a picture that much of the public gets. I know that as I was working on putting this show together, and some of the people that I know that come up and talk to me have said, oh, Failure to Launch. Oh, you mean like that TV show? I go, no, not exactly. You know, the movie. They talked about the movie with Matthew McConaughey or something like that. And I went, no, it really is a lot different. And others came up. But one of the questions that a couple of people brought up that I thought would be a good one to share with you is, You talk about your assessment and your evaluation that you do for 2 weeks. What are the signs that the parents can look at? I mean, we all know the obvious one. Your child is 32 years old and still lives in your basement. But beyond that, what are some of the signs, maybe as they're getting, you know, before you get to that point, that parents can start seeing that maybe they need to start doing something different?
Well, I tell you what, it really goes back, Alan, into adolescence. And I'll try not to be too drawn out in a technical sense. Developmentally, If you look at the work of Eric Erickson, there are 8 stages of personality development that take place within the lifetime of a human being. The 5th stage of development actually occurs in the teen years, and that is called ego identity versus confusion. It is a seminal age. Number one, you will see a lot of people a lot of young adults and teenagers who actually begin their experimentation with drugs and substances around that age. There are some of us, Alan, of our generation, who still walk around and say, boy, they ought to make junior high school illegal, because it's such a difficult time for young people to go through. The parents, what they can look for is a sudden, not sudden, but a definite lack of interest in things that motivate their young person, a seeming attitude shift. And the best way to describe it, even though it's cliche, would be a shift in the young person's attitude of the glass is half empty instead of half full. Watching them gradually draw back from challenges and voicing opinions and making comments about, well, it probably wouldn't turn out good anyway, I might as well not try, etc. Now, what the parents need to know is that, and Alan, you and I know, agree on this, no parent on earth has ever woken up in the morning and said, how can I screw up my kid today? That's not what happened. But there are things that we unknowingly do that actually influence a developing adolescent and a young adult that can actually lead to exacerbating substance use. Part of that, for instance, I have a quote in front of me from a 2004 study, Parenting Styles. That is the work of Diana Baumrind. The parenting styles being authoritative, authoritarian, and permissive. Parenting styles influence the achievement of identity in adolescence. A parenting style emphasizing high standards and high communication encourages adolescents' exploration in a supportive environment. A parenting style that emphasizes high standards but low communication may interfere with the healthy exploration of identity potential. Permissive parents, those enablers that you spoke of earlier, who do not establish standards for adolescents, are encouraging a diffused identity, which means one that is not clear and that is not understood, with no clear commitments. Now, what all of that language translates into is that when parents are permissive, their children, their offspring, their young adults will tend to collect a group of coping skills rather than establishing an identity. They will play a role, if you will, such as the child at home or the victim of circumstance, rather than developing an identity, which basically, when you come down to it, that's a set of internalized moral values upon which we make decisions. So, Alan, if you wanted to know about my identity, it wouldn't have to do with a guy in his 60s with short hair who wears sport coats. It would have to do with, I won't put up with watching an animal be abused. I think every young person deserves multiple chances to find their way in the world. So it's about that and the development of those moral values as the backbone of identity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And as you were saying that, I started to visualize some of the families that we've worked with. And the term that came to mind was, I had parents or relatives asking, saying, well, I don't understand. Why does this young person need to go away to get this treatment? Why do they have to go to somewhere that's far off? Why can't they just stay at home and get it? And I've said, because this child needs a parentectomy. That's the first thing they need.
I want you to know that when I changed careers, Alan, there was a psychiatrist where I was working in an outpatient clinic when I first started, and she used that very same term, parentectomy.
Yeah.
And that isn't about the parents being bad people or doing bad things.
No.
It's about they unknowingly actually strengthen the dysfunction within their child, and a separation from that is a good thing. So, Alan, what I do and what we do here at Decision Point is we think of a person coming to our program, 2 weeks of assessment, 30 more days of core treatment, the possibility of 45 days of extended treatment followed by our own transitional living. We think of that as a contrived developmental crisis that the young adult enters back into in order to achieve the developmental milestones that they missed the first time.
And it makes perfect sense. And I know that as I was reading more about the program before this interview, I noticed that you have a large focus on connecting back to the community. So share with us a little bit about how you have that part of the program set up to where they're not only connected back into their family, but the community as a whole.
I got you. Alan, you're familiar with this, and if there are parents listening out there, some of them are going to be familiar with this too. We get amazing, intelligent, articulate young adults in our program, and it is just astounding what they do not know or understand about day-to-day functioning in the world. We get people who have no idea how to do a checkbook or budgeting. We have young people who don't understand the concept of financial investing and the miracle of compounding interest. We have young people who do not understand the plethora of educational opportunities that are out there and different ways to finance it. So what we do is I bring those people to our clients. I bring them in periodically. For instance, I'm scheduling now with a financial investor advisor to come in. I'm going to have a representative of one of the universities down in Phoenix come up and actually spend time with us and explain the wide variety of educational opportunities that are available just at that one school. And then, Alan, what we do, even if a student were in school and ran into a substance abuse problem and doesn't want to wreck their transcript, we have installed Wi-Fi at our residential facilities, and we are perfectly willing to work with the university for the person to do distance learning on at least their core subjects, so that coming here to our program doesn't interfere with their educational career or mess up their transcript.
Well, and I say, and not only doesn't it interfere with it, but in many cases, being out of the environment that they were in before, all of a sudden now there may not be the temptations that are out there. And they can stay a little more focused. So it makes perfect sense to me.
Absolutely. One of the developmental stages is industry versus inferiority. And let's face it, for a young adult, for an adolescent, for a child, school is their industry. So when they do well in school, because of the environment they're put in or the conditions they're put in, or being able to take them into another environment like the treatment environment where they can not only get help but focus, they begin to build confidence in themselves because they look back and say, you know what, I can do this stuff. I can make good grades. I can achieve. I do believe that I'm capable.
I mean, again, as I'm looking and I'm seeing that we're getting an email question coming over right now, so I would like to share this as it seems like it sort of, it fits right now. This one reads, my niece is a lovely girl, but she is 27 and can't seem to make it on her own. She will move out of my sister's home, and a few months later, she's right back in again. Each time, there is a new excuse. Either her boyfriend dumped her, her roommate's impossible to live with, as well as she can't keep a steady job, and it is the employer's fault, you know, in her mind for that. Once she's back home, she sits all day in front of the computer or the TV playing games and staying on social media. Every time my sister and any of us in the family try to motivate her or talk to her about it, she stomps out of the room either crying or angry. What is your advice about a situation like this?
Okay, gotcha. Number one, she's talking about a completely, she just described failure to launch.
That's what I thought.
She just described that perfectly. I can tell you what's going on. Communication between this young adult and the rest of the family is not clear. She, due to her reaction stomping out of the room, what she is hearing when the rest of the family try to motivate her, what she's hearing is, you're a failure, you're not good enough, you have to do something different, you must do better. And that's what she's hearing. I don't want the person who sent you the email to listen to us now and think that I'm saying that the family is saying those things. There's a big difference between what the family is saying and what this young adult hears them saying. So this is a person. Unfortunately, if there is not an intervention in her life, what she is piling up is a resume of evidence for herself that she actually can't make it independently, that she actually isn't competent and industrious. That's why an intervention would be called for at this time. I want you and the rest of your audience to hear this. In the past, there was no treatment for addiction at all in the far past, as Alan, as you and I both know.
Yep.
But the way it's swung nowadays is actually around to, hey, everybody's an addict.
Yeah.
And you know what? That's not the truth. The new DSM-5 criteria, and for you folks out there, that's just the book that we go by in behavioral health that tells us what a diagnosis would be. Those new criteria look at substance use disorders as a continuum. There could be a person who at critical times in their life uses substances, and they result in very bad relational consequences. There could be a person who tends to binge on the weekends, all the way up to the individual who literally is in a back alley shooting heroin into their vein. But what we need to understand is that when these young people come to us, we don't need to hang the label addict on them. We need to simply look at them and say, hey, let us help you figure out how much of a negative impact substance use has had on you and on your life. Alan, the last thing, when she was talking about this young person and advice, the last thing, there really needs to be a lot of work with this individual around her identity and around what she has passion for. because what you're experiencing here is a real lack of passion. And I also hear an avoidance of close relationships. Social media have taken away what those of us who didn't grow up with that really enjoy, which is looking into another person's eyes, communicating and relating to them, which today is still a necessary job skill.
Yep. No, I completely agree, and I think the other thing that that I got out of it also is that, you know, there's no level of responsibility, of personal responsibility, you know, that at some point that particular skill has evaded her, because, you know, it's everybody's fault. It's the boyfriend's fault. It's the roommate's fault. It's the employer's fault. And I'm not going to sit and talk to anybody about that. So I'm not going to listen to anything that might put the focus on me. I agree with you. I think this is one of those situations that's very close to exactly what you're working with. Now, for
Alan, she's demonstrating through those statements, she's demonstrating that she mostly has an external locus of control. Mm-hmm. It's not about her. It's not about what she does or doesn't do. It's about, like you said, the boyfriend, the boss, etc.
Yep. Now, for everybody out there, if you want to follow along with us, you can go to Decision Point's website. Obviously, not if you're driving out there, but for those of you sitting at your computer, if you go to decisionpointcenter.com, that's decisionpointcenter.com. You can open up another window. You can follow along with us. Now, we're going to take a break. We will be back in about a minute. And just remember, the subject matter is the cart before the horse, and you're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family on LA Talk Radio. Our subject is the cart before the horse? Our guest is Gary Hees, and if you opened up another window on your computer, you're looking at Decision Point Center's website as well. Now, Gary, we've talked, you know, a lot about as far as, you know, how important the community is, and how important the family is. Lately in the news, there's been a lot of talk about trauma. You know, that, you know, the people are going through trauma. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of traumatic events that have happened. So we hear what is the psychological response to the trauma. Share with us a little bit about the correlation between addiction and trauma.
Oh my gosh. In many, many cases, it's extremely high. It just depends on the studies that you look at in the literature. One of the foremost studies in the literature correlates any type of childhood physical or sexual abuse at an 85% correlation with substance use disorders of one degree or another. Lots of times, what we will see is even if someone doesn't experience abuse when they are a child, what we will see is once they enter the drug culture, they will unintentionally get themselves in positions where they are taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. And that's not to blame the victim at all. The victim
isn't the
crime. But they are much more vulnerable in an intoxicated state or when they're high, and there are those who will definitely take advantage of that. So when we have young adults, for instance, come in, it may be past instances of childhood sexual trauma. It may be sexual trauma that was experienced out in the drug culture. It could be a lot of different things, including, unfortunately, sexual assault taking place on a campus. The way we approach that is utilizing EMDR, eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. This is nowadays the treatment of choice on the part of the Department of Defense for returning veterans from the Middle East. It is a highly effective way to address this. I am, in fact, level 2 trained in EMDR, but I contract that work out to what is called an EMDR consultant, that is, an individual who helps with and aids in the training of clinicians in doing EMDR. It is quite effective. Some of the older techniques are to simply talk, or to do gestalt exercises where there is physical emoting going on. Sometimes gestalt is called for, and if that happens, that's something that I facilitate myself. EMDR, though, in most cases, is highly effective in not removing a traumatic memory, but removing the emotional impact and emotional content of the memory, where the victim of such a heinous act can literally look back and say, well, you know what? That happened to me. It is part of my life. I had nothing to do with it. None of it was my fault. And I don't have to be, I don't have to react in such a way that it wrecks my present life because of what happened to me in the past.
Oh, that's great. Is there an example, I mean, for some of the people that are now trying to visualize this, sort of give an example as to what it is that you're reading through the EMDR and how it's able to, how the person that you're working with now is able to recognize that what you're telling them is now beneficial.
Gotcha. EMDR operates on the adaptive information processing model. And now I'm going to speak plain English, so you guys don't fall backwards. All it really means, and if I put this in real plain language, is that when a traumatic event occurs, there is tremendous emotionality around it. Our brain is built to process things, literally taking them in, assigning meaning and content to it, feeling about it, and then letting it go. That doesn't happen with trauma. Trauma,
gotcha.
Trauma is so intense an experience in the brain and the connotations of what it means to us as an individual that it doesn't process through. It gets stuck. What has been discovered is that bilateral stimulation of the brain, that is, someone holding vibrating what we call buzzies in their left and right hand with the buzzing alternating from right to left, or the more familiar version of EMDR where someone is moving their hand back and forth and the person is holding their head still and simply following the motion of the fingers with their eyes. What happens we now know, when the brain is bilaterally stimulated with that left to right movement or left to right input from the buzzies or a light or even tapping, we now know that what happens is that actually facilitates the memory coming free and being processed through the brain as it normally would. Now, in EMDR, here's the wonderful thing about it. I can do, Alan, EMDR with a person who's been traumatized without them telling me any specifics about the trauma. They do it. What happens, and I have a trauma background myself, and I did EMDR for myself. What happens is, it's very much like you're sitting on a train looking out a window, and as you do the eye movements, memories are released out of your brain and they come up. You feel them, you experience them, and they pass through. And then your brain presents you the next one, and the next, and the next. And the truth is, in my case, Alan, some of the difficulties I had relating to people at my work directly connected back to memories of what went on in my childhood and in my teen years. So it has an amazing impact of releasing and freeing a person to be who they were meant to be, rather than being someone limited by the horrific trauma that they've been through.
Well, that is a great explanation, and I hope that, and I know that we get not only parents that listen, but professionals that listen and such, and you know, I think that will be very helpful for them to understand the value of it. We have another email message that has come in. This one reads, I work for a medical marijuana business in California, and I have a couple of comments that do not bode well for the industry that employs me. I'm seeing more and more young adults with, and this is in quotes, conditions that qualify them for using the substance. Some of them are even my friends. Too many of them are in what I call a hazy daisy, just doing the minimum, dropping out of college and wasting their talents. I believe that the marijuana is partially responsible for this condition. In your work, what is your experience?
Well, let me tell the individual who made the comment, my experience is their experience. There are two things that are almost universal among the young adults that we see at Decision Point. One, marijuana use, and two, addiction to nicotine. Both of those things are almost universally true. No matter what anyone wants to say about marijuana, you can usually, looking at an addict's history, trace back and see where that was one of the drugs, or it and alcohol together, that actually began the person's usage of substances in order to cope with life. You and I, Alan, cope with life by talking about it, by meeting friends and discussing it, by deciding what our limits are of what we can affect and what we can't affect. The use of substances to cope with life is a dual issue, because the substances will create, over time, either psychological or physical or both, dependence on the part of the user. And at the same time, the individual is not getting on board the life skills that would lead them to be confident in themselves and be able to fully participate in life. Like your writer said, sort of a hazy daisy, I'll do the minimum type of thing. Unfortunately, my experience in dealing with young adults is that when we talk to them, when they are out of the haze, when they are fully participating again in life, that they'll basically look up and say, well, you know, even though I was using it, I knew I wasn't doing anything constructive. And what I decided was I just wasn't worth the effort and that it was never going to change. And, oh, my gosh, Ellen, what a tragic thing.
Yes.
And you know, we had a young man come through Decision Point, and literally when I was questioning him, when I sat in on a group one day, he mentioned, well, you know, I did drop out of school. And I asked the young man, you dropped out of school. Well, how many hours do you have left? You know what his answer was?
What's that?
12. He had 12 hours of school left to have a bachelor's in business administration. And I looked at him and said, you know what? I don't want you to focus on smart recovery or the 12 steps or celebrate recovery. Your assignment for tonight is to go home and call your school back and see what it takes to complete that last semester.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wonderful young man. Very bright. Very bright. Very fun to be around.
Well, and I love the success stories. Anybody that's listened to the show knows that that's one of my favorite parts of doing the show. I'm looking up and seeing we're starting to run a little bit short of time, and one of the areas that I know you have some information on is the statistics. So I know that obviously addiction is a tough road, as the statistics show, but if you can share with our listeners what the latest statistics are telling us, that they can kind of get a better perspective of the enormity of this problem.
Oh, well, I tell you what, enormity, I think, is an absolutely correct word to use, Alan. Among people age 12 or older, 20.2 million people needed treatment for an illicit drug or alcohol use problem in the past year, but did not receive treatment of any kind at any kind of specialized facility. More than 7 million U.S. adults report having co-occurring disorders. And for you folks out there, co-occurring disorders means a substance use disorder or issue in tandem with a mental health problem, which makes it much more difficult to address both, because unfortunately, the mental health issue and the substance use issue, they work synergistically to keep the person down, if you will. So it takes specialized approaches in order to really work with them. By 2020, and this is one I really like people to pay attention to, by the year 2020, 5 years from now, mental and substance use disorders will surpass all physical diseases as a major cause of disability worldwide.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that. That is just, that's just beyond perception right now.
Well, Alan, those statistics are coming out of the National Institute on Drug Abuse and the National Institutes of Health. That is what is projected to happen.
Wow. Now, how much of this is that we are having more mental health issues, and how much of this is we had them, we're just now learning how to recognize them?
Well, part of it is we're now learning how to recognize different things. For instance, one of the most prevalent examples of that would be the rise in the diagnosis of autism, or the spectrum disorders such as Asperger's. Now that we've gotten better at diagnosing them and knowing what we're looking at, there are more diagnoses around them. A lot of this, unfortunately, there are lots of things to point at. I would tell parents out there, for instance, if you have a legitimate need to have painkillers or anti-anxiety drugs in your home, please secure those. Tremendous percentages of adolescents and young adults either make money by stealing those from their parents and selling them, or begin using prescription painkillers by using a prescription that's available to them that's not theirs. And what we have now, Alan, is a tremendous correlation between someone beginning using prescription painkillers such as OxyContin and then moving on to heroin.
Yeah, and I have been, you know, obviously, through what we do and just really paying attention to what's going on out there, seeing the huge rise in heroin use. And here we had a drug that had its heyday, and we thought it was determined that, you know, about how bad it was, and it really went to a point of being a very, very small part of the abuse that was being put out there, to now that having this huge rise again. Why is that, and what can we do about it?
Well, number one, we have to educate sooner. Parents have to develop the attitude that if they think something is wrong, they absolutely trust their gut. I have two adult offspring now. My son is 30, my daughter is 27. One of the hardest lessons for me to learn, especially in late adolescence with them, was that there was not a way on earth that I could be their parent and their friend. Being a parent doesn't mean being popular. It means being protectively suspicious when you see a change happening in the personality of your child. It means getting in the way. It means standing for what your gut tells you is right, no matter what is thrown at you as an excuse or as a reason why you should be quiet and walk away. In a lot of cases, it means you being willing to be the not cool parent in your child's circle of friends. And unfortunately, being in this business, Alan, the really tough part of it is the consistency with which young, wonderful, intelligent adults are found dead from overdoses of prescription drugs, dead from overdoses of heroin and other illicit drugs as well. It's one of those things where it may sound crass, and I don't mean it to, but our parents out there have to be more willing to do what's right than to be liked by their child.
Yeah. And I thank you so much for bringing up that point, because I think it's huge for many of the parents out there to hear it and to understand it. And I've made a similar comment to parents, and at one point in speaking to a PTA group, saying, you know, just cut to the chase. Your parent does not, or your child does not need a 45-year-old best friend. Your parent needs, your child needs a parent that understands parenting skills. So, yes, I could not agree more. So I appreciate you bringing that up. I just look at, we are just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to add about the topic or that you want the audience to know about what your center is doing?
Gosh, our center is trying to work with young adults. We are trying to gain to agree with them on where they stand, not label them. The old methodology that's been around so long is put a plug in the jug, shut your mouth, go to meetings and listen. That message is not ringing true with young adults. What we need to do with them is help them understand what a substance use disorder has done to their life, help them understand the options that they have for peer support, not just AA, and help them understand what developmentally where they can go and how capable and what a wonderful and rewarding life can be out there ahead of them, rather than them sitting around and thinking, I'm not good enough and I'll never be good enough.
Well, I appreciate it so much. I appreciate you coming on. Again, for those people out there, it's decisionpointcenter.com. If you're driving, if you can't write this down, go to the Answers for the Family website, and all of Gary's information will be on there, as well as Decision Points. Gary, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Keep up the good work, and hopefully I will see you at the next conference.
You betcha. Alan, thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to seeing you out there, too.
All right. Thank you. Take care. And for everybody out there, please like us on Facebook and LinkedIn, and if you listen to us through iTunes or Stitcher, if you find the information here of value, please leave a comment for others who might also be able to get value from the show. Have a great week, and be good humans. Good afternoon.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.